When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, you're listening to Human Conditions, a podcast about radical 20th century thought, which is part of the LRB's Close Reading series. I'm your host, Adam Schatz, and my guest is the distinguished philosopher Judith Butler. The subject of this episode, the fourth episode of Human Conditions, is The Human Condition, a work of political philosophy published in 1958 by Hannah Arendt. Arendt was born in 1906 into a comfortable secular Jewish family in Linden, Germany. She studied theology as a young woman in Berlin and then went to Marburg to study under the philosopher Martin Heidegger. They had a long and troubled relationship, both intellectual and personal. Heidegger was becoming enthralled by the Nazi Party, which he saw as the political, almost messianic realization of his philosophical project. As a Jew, Arendt could in no way share this enthusiasm. Still, Heidegger's existentialism would leave a lasting imprint on her thinking, even as she incorporated other influences and developed a distinctive philosophy of her own, one that was resolutely anti-authoritarian. In 1933, Arendt fled to France, where she remained until 1941, when she escaped once again, this time to the United States. Over the next three decades, she became one of the world's leading intellectuals, writing almost entirely in English, and publishing some of the most influential works of political philosophy of the 20th century, including The Origins of Totalitarianism, The Human Condition, On Revolution, and Eichmann and Jerusalem, a report on the banality of evil that first appeared in The New Yorker. She was the worldliest of philosophers, drawing upon her vast training in classical languages and existential philosophy to comment on the experience of being a stateless refugee, which she'd known personally, the relationship between racism, imperialism, and genocide, the Vietnam War and the student movements, the question of violence, and the history of revolutions. She was also fiercely independent in her views on Israel and Zionism. In the 1930s, she became involved in the Zionist movement out of an urgent sense that Jews menaced by fascism had nowhere else to go but Palestine. But by the early 1940s, she turned against the leadership of the Zionist movement, and when the state was founded, she became one of its most eloquent critics, not least for having created a new class of stateless refugees, the Palestinians. Arendt has gone in and out of fashion over the years, and the last few years she's been criticized by some thinkers on the left for her purported Eurocentrism and for her controversial essay on Little Rock, for which she belatedly apologized in a letter to Ralph Ellison. The Origins of Totalitarianism and Eichmann in Jerusalem, however, remain critical reference points for the study of authoritarianism and the ways in which ordinary people end up becoming complicit in barbarous political systems. And in the mid-20th century, she had few equals in her reflections on the relationship between thought and political action, a question that lies at the heart of her dense and challenging book, The Human Condition. The Human Condition originated as a series of lectures that Arendt gave at the University of Chicago in the spring of 1956 and was initially conceived as part of a larger project on what Marxism had contributed to the disaster of totalitarianism. Arendt did not abandon the critique of Marxism, but she folded it into a reflection that is much more abstract than Origins. The book is divided into six parts: the human condition, the public and private realm, labor, work, and action, and the vita activa and the modern age. How these sections form a whole is somewhat elusive at first. As the Arendt scholar Margaret Canavan has observed, The Human Condition is, quote, a long, complex piece of writing that conforms to no established pattern, crammed with unexpected insights, but lacking a clearly apparent argumentative structure. Adding to the bewilderment of some readers is the proliferation of references to classical Greek philosophy. But if you read the book with the care and patience it demands, Arendt's project comes into focus. Essentially, this is a study of what she considers to be the three forms of activity that are fundamental to the human condition: labor, work, and action. And at its core is her fascination with the beginnings that human action makes possible, or what she calls natality. So for all its abstractions, the human condition is very much a reflection on the concrete problems of the world, of how we think about it and how we act upon it. It opens with reflections on the launch of the first space satellite in 1957 and often alludes to such events as the 1956 Hungarian Revolution, from which she drew particular inspiration. In my discussion with Judith, we'll be focusing on the prologue and the section on action, which aren't considered the most exalted of human activities. Judith, first of all, I'd like to ask you why you chose the human condition rather than the more obvious Arendt choices, or the origins of totalitarianism or Eichmann in Jerusalem. Why is this book so important?
Well, first of all, it seemed to me that in a series called Human Conditions, it would be odd not to examine a book called The Human Condition. But also, we've talked about Simone de Beauvoir, we've talked about Jean-Paul Sartre, we've talked about Frantz Fanon, all of whom are philosophers of freedom in one way or another. And Hannah Arendt, too, is a philosopher of freedom, not a form of radical freedom that exercised by individuals alone, but rather freedom that assumes the form of what she called concerted action that we undertake with others in a collaborative way. That's the way we act in a free way. That's how we bring freedom into the world. So all of these writers, in my view, are not naive about freedom. They don't think, oh, you're free and you can act and all is well. They're asking what it means to be free under conditions of constraint. And that has always been, for me, a central question in my own work, right? Are we free to choose our gender, or do we struggle to find our way with gender under conditions of constraint? Are we free as individuals like Antigone, who sought to bury her brother alone and eschewed all efforts that her sister made to join in solidarity with her? No, not that kind of freedom. Freedom that actually leads us closer to an idea of collaboration, plurality, even solidarity. I think the reflections on action are philosophically incisive and innovative. She herself is beginning something new by thinking about action this way, which is perhaps paradoxical given how many classical references there are in this book. But she is asking us to think about freedom not as making something up, not as some endowment that the individual has, but as something that happens between us in sites of gathering, and that our action is a way of beginning something new. I think she is, in her writing, always trying to begin something new. So I guess the question for us in reading her is, was she successful? Did she start something new? Why is it that people are drawn to her, and perhaps increasingly so in the last years?
This book is published in between Origins and her books on Eichmann and Revolution, and it's a much more explicitly philosophical work. What do you think is its relation to the books that it's sandwiched in between, broadly speaking?
I think we can see that Arendt is taking distance from ideas of sovereignty, state sovereignty in particular, and trying to understand what it means for people to act together who are perhaps not
organized into states.
Yes, well, or they don't have the permission of the state.
Right, as in the case of the Hungarian Revolution.
Right, or in the case of civil disobedience, because sometimes civil disobedience is not authorized by the state against which it acts, and on what authority do people then gather and resist in the way that they do? So I think she was always trying to think about what she called plurality, social plurality, for her political plurality, apart from state structures and framed in a way that sets aside sovereignty or even shows that sovereignty, which has been a concept in political theory for so long, is not the framework through which to ask fundamental questions about action, authority, and freedom.
And as you were saying, for her, action is never isolated. It's always about acting together. And I think that this challenges a somewhat complacent portrait or critique of Arendt as a kind of Cold War liberal. She believed in collective action.
I think she did. I think we could imagine, we would be right to imagine that she's thinking about the resistance to Nazism. On what grounds do people resist fascist power, fascist states? She's thinking about civil disobedience, which is, of course, already an issue, not just in the U.S., but in Eastern Europe during that time. She's also thinking about how revolutions are undertaken and how people bring new law into existence or a new sense of the polity to which they belong. She's seeing a series of revolutions. And in her view, none of these are necessitated by historical determinism, right? We can't say, oh, revolution is predictable, or if this and this happens, there will be revolution.
Right. It's not just because people are poor, because they're oppressed, or they're suffering from scarcity. She has a non-materialist understanding of this.
Well, she does in a way, I mean, you're right, to the degree that she says material conditions alone cannot bring a revolution about. On the other hand, she does call it a kind of point of materiality when people gather together as bodies in proximity, collaborate and act in concert. That is, for her, a material moment. I think, yes, yeah, she opposes most forms of materialism. She fears biological reductionism. She doesn't want the human to be reduced to its mere biological living. We could talk about that, but
do you think it's because she feels that these sort of mechanistic understandings of political action, in a sense, ignore the question of human agency and therefore remove the question of freedom? I mean, if political action is merely determined by scarcity or need or oppression, where's the freedom in rebellion?
Yes, I think that that's true. I think in particular, she didn't like forms of historical determinism, right? Not all forms of materialism are deterministic, but the ones she really didn't like were the deterministic ones. Like, oh, once these conditions are established, then revolution follows in a predictable way. So she thought, no, where freedom is at issue, there's always an element of unpredictability. And we need to savor that.
Thanks for listening to this extract from Human Conditions, a close reading series from the London Review of Books. To listen to the full episode and all our other close reading series, sign up to our close reading subscription at lrb.me/closereadings or click on the link in the description.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.